is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, March 6, 2020. I'm Buster Olney. And back at the board in Bristol, Taylor Schwenk and Troy Farkas. Some headlines for today. The White Sox agree to an extension with third baseman Yoan Moncada, 5 years and $70 million. The Red Sox announced yesterday that Chris Sale has a flexor strain. He won't throw for a week. Let's face it, they have no idea if he's going to be able to help them out this year. Miguel Cabrera was a bunch of Tigers hitters who did damage against the Yankees' Gerrit Cole on Thursday.
Fly ball to center off the bat of Miguel Cabrera. Watch it fly. Gone. Oh, he hit it a mile.
Oh, pumped it out deep.
It's on K-Line Field. To be fair, the wind's blowing out that way. That's K-Line Field way back behind that walkway there.
That from Dan Dickerson, Kirk Gibson on the Tigers Radio Network. Yeah, it was a really windy day. Cole allowed 6 runs, 6 hits, and 1 walk in 2 innings with 3 strikeouts. And despite the subpar outing, he said he remains on track for opening day. Today, we'll be talking with ESPN's Kylie McDaniel about his newly released list of Major League Baseball's top 100 prospects and an interesting firing over Pine Tar. But first, it's March, and you know what that means. The madness is upon us. Dive into all the craziness that college basketball has to offer by listening to Courtside with Seth Greenberg and Dan Dockich. Next week, they're going to look back at all the regular season races and preview the big conference tournaments. And then, come Selection Sunday, the guys will be breaking down every matchup in the bracket, helping you dominate the office pool. It's Courtside with Greenberg and Dockich. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Kylie McDaniel covers prospects for ESPN. He's a co-author of the forthcoming book, Future Value, The Battle for Baseball's Soul and How Teams Will Find the Next Superstar. What's the release date on that, Kylie?
I've gotten different dates, but it's the first week of April is what is the consistent part.
All right. So when that book comes out, we're going to have you on again to talk specifically about that. You also penned the article that came out this week on ESPN.com, the top 100 list of prospects. Before we get to that, we always have like an initiation thing for people on the podcast for the first time. Tell me who your favorite team was growing up and tell me who your guy was, like your favorite player.
So, my whole family's from the South, mostly Georgia and Alabama, and I grew up in Tampa before we had a team in Tampa. And so the Braves on TBS was sort of the big thing. And actually it was probably Chipper Jones who was, I guess he was in a meeting with us yesterday. So. Yeah. And then as I got older, we got the team in Tampa with the Rays, but that the Rays coming to Tampa and then me getting into baseball and having no favorite team anymore all happened in like 5 or 6 years.
So tell me, I was just going to say, you know, he was in the meeting with us yesterday. Had you ever met him before?
When I worked for the Braves, he would be around sort of like pre-draft workouts and things like that. So we had shook hands before, but he's, I don't know, there's something not unapproachable about him, but it's almost like I, in my mind, create that he's unapproachable just because he's, you know, so up there as a player. Because now I've, you know, I've met a handful of big leaguers, like Fred McGriff would be around too. Not to say Fred's not a great player, but I don't know, it's just sort of imposing in a way.
All right, so have you had a conversation with him where you told him, hey, you were my favorite guy growing up, like we hear happens between players at first base a lot?
No, we chatted for about 30 seconds yesterday, and people kept grabbing him. So we haven't gotten there yet, but I'll see him at the Braves spring training game later today. So maybe I'll find some time then.
All right. Before we get to your rankings and the players who are in the top 10, I want to ask you, big picture, how much has analytics come into for you sort of generating this list, you know, versus word of mouth and what you see in your own eyes with these players?
Oh, I've noticed even in just the last like 3 or 4 years, that the analytics have changed a lot because, you know, you would do a list and you would get to the, you know, the third or fourth best pitcher on a team, not a consensus top 100 guy. And one guy would say his fastball plays, he gets great swing and miss and, you know, a scout. And then another scout that saw him another guy would say, oh, it doesn't play. Like it's too flat. It gets whacked around. And it's like one guy saw him strike out 12. One guy saw him strike out 6. I'd ask him what day they saw him. And you wouldn't be able to really reconcile those two things unless you got like a fourth, a fifth, a sixth account, or if you had a front office that would like sort of tell you about them in great detail. You'd like really need to get down the road like a half dozen sources to really know the answer. And now I can just call like an area scout on a team that's never seen him before. He can pull it up and be like, oh yeah, his tracking characteristics are very good for swing and miss. And then you can ask a second guy and he'll be like, yeah, we agree. And then you've got the answer. And no, none of those guys saw him. And the same thing happens with swings where you can talk about average and max exit velos, you know, launch angles, things like that. When you're just trying to figure out where a guy is on the trajectory of like where their skills are going and what they're improving at and what their weaknesses are, like you can quantify a lot of those things in a way that teams all sort of understand and comprehend it on the same level now.
Boy, and it feels like we can trust that so much more than when I first started covering baseball, that when you talk to a scout and say, that guy, he's got huge power. And they would put it on the scout 20 to 80 scale, but at the same time, you didn't know what was behind it.
Yeah, and now they'll put the exit velos on a 20 to 80 scale. And there's a lot of times when they don't perfectly match up. Like if somebody wants to be of the point of view saying that these statistics don't actually predict things as much as a scout can, I think there are times, especially when you get down to high school, college, rookie ball, where there are things that the numbers cannot understand about a guy's mechanics, or this guy grunts when he throws a changeup, or he hides the ball behind his body. Like there's certain things you have to at least have eyeballs on via video or being in the park or knowing the player. And there's a lot of times when exit velo does not match up with power in ways that, you know, mechanics can sort of explain it, or he can really turn on a ball inside, but he has trouble on balls away, and so that's pulling down his exit velo, but we think it's going to increase in the future. Like, there's a lot of granularity to explaining it, but it's a really good, like, measure to start with to sort of understand where a guy is.
All right, you said a phrase in our production room yesterday that I'm sure caught the attention of a lot of people in the room when you mentioned that this potentially the best prospect class since the one with Mike Trout and Bryce Harper. Give us some background on that.
Yeah, there was a prospect class where Harper and Trout were 1 and 2. And Wander Franco, the top guy in this year's rankings, and as far as I've seen, everyone's rankings has him number one. He seems like a very consensus choice. He's the first guy since that class where you look at the top of a prospect ranking and say, it's hard to imagine how that guy's not going to succeed. Like, he has such great contact skills, speed and defense, power, the whole thing. If two of them completely crater, he's still a pretty good 2 or 3 win player that'll play every day. And that doesn't happen very often. And so having that at the top, and then having, you know, multiple guys that throw 100 up near the top that like haven't had arm surgery. You know, Adley Rutschman might be one of the best catching prospects in recent memory. Luis Robert might have the highest upside of all of these guys. It's a really exciting time, I think, both for young players in the big leagues and also for young players at the top of the minors. And I also point out yesterday that I expect 8 out of the top 10 guys on the list to be in the big leagues at some point this year, or at least be good enough to be up there and then maybe get their service time messed with, which is not usually the very top of the list, that they're all sort of big league ready in a way.
Who does Wander Franco remind you of?
That's a tough one, because when you get to that like upper tier of, he's like sort of expected to be one of the top 5 or 10 players in baseball if everything sort of goes to plan. There's not like a sort of squatty, explosive shortstop. Like, I mean, obviously you have a, you know, bigger library than I do. Yeah. So, I mean, there's characteristics that he has. I think Francisco Lindor might be the closest guy, but Lindor is like a totally different sort of physicality and like hitting mechanics. So it's not a perfect comp, but I think you can pick almost any elite shortstop or infielder or even center fielder, and you're going to see a lot of things in common with Franco, but I don't think there's anything he does that is, you know, oh, this guy matches that guy. He's going to be just like this guy.
When does he begin to manifest in the big leagues in your eyes?
There's an argument that he's already big league ready, but obviously Tampa is both so deep and so mindful of service time, that it'll be a little while. I think in the second half of the season, especially if there is an injury to one of their, you know, main cogs of their offense, that this guy is probably their best option. And especially once you get past that Super 2 deadline, there will be no reason to sort of keep him down at that point. And I've been told that they're going to start playing him at second base, third base, outfield, so that when that time comes that he is the best option, that he won't be playing that position for the first time in the big league. So I would, you know, sometime after the All-Star break, I think would be like a reasonable time to start looking for where a spot in their lineup makes sense for him.
Tell us about your best pitching prospect.
Jesus Luzardo is with the Oakland A's. He was traded from Washington in the Madison Doolittle deal. And I think the interesting thing about him is he is not your typical physicality to a pitching prospect. He's 5'11", 205, 210. He's been roughly that size since back in high school, and he's had two different big spikes in his velo and his stuff, along with the Tommy John surgery. So it's just we're one of those, like, there is no such thing as a pitching prospect, because, like, whoever would have seen that guy as a 17-year-old and thought, oh, he'll be, you know, sitting at 97 with a 70 slider and also have a surgery. Like, it's sort of impossible to see that coming. But it's, you know, on the 2080 or I guess 2-8 scouting scale, he's got 2-7 pitches in his fastball and a slider. He comes at you, throws strikes. He's got a usable changeup. He can do it in short stints. He can do it as a starter. Like he can kind of do everything, even though you probably wouldn't have seen this coming. And just like watching him in a bullpen, you might wonder like, oh, what's this going to look like? And there's other guys like Nate Pearson, the second pitching prospect, who's just a giant that throws 103. Like that's kind of what you're expecting on a list like this.
Yeah, that's what, when you use the word physicality, I was going to transition that into a conversation about Nate Pearson. Cause that's, you know, when the first time I saw him, like, boy, that guy's a hoss. Like to me, he's the closest thing as someone who covered Roger Clemens to a Roger Clemens, that big guy who just seems like throwing 103 just looks natural for him.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. You can throw that hard and have it not be, have that much like effort to it where you're like, oh, well, this guy's, you know, grunting and spitting and, you know, pulling his head to the side. He has no idea where it's going. That's what you think that looks like. But, yeah, another thing that happens with pitching prospects is there's a lot of teenagers that are 6'5", 180, and you're trying to guess how much they're going to fill out. And they're always, you know, like Kevin Gausman, like they're always pretty lanky. And then every now and then you get a guy that just is an enormous dude that, you know, maybe could have played tight end in the NFL. And that's what you have with Pearson. And, yeah, he throws 103. He can throw a slider as high as like 93. It's almost hard to grade his stuff because there's not like other 103 mile an hour fastballs and 93 mile an hour sliders. Like maybe Syndergaard would be the best comparison in terms of like the raw stuff and the physicality and kind of the upside, really.
Now, their front office is typically very disciplined in how they promote players and how they incorporate young players. So I suspect that it'll take some time for him to build up innings and really manifest the big league level. Yes.
Yes. I think he may also be a victim of the service time stuff just because he's going to be so good. And I don't think they are necessarily at the top of the AL East this year. And so I think, and then he's also, you know, just got to AAA. Like there's a compelling reason to leave him there and let him work some things out and sort of see how it goes so that you can sort of unleash him for those 6 or 7 years of control when they're going to be higher on the list of contenders.
All right. Tell us about Julio Rodriguez of the Mariners.
So he was the guy I think I might be most bullish on relative to the rest of the industry. He basically has all the same, Joe Adell with the Angels, I think is like a more recognizable guy that's been higher on a lot of other lists that's already gotten to AAA and is very close to the big leagues. Julio Rodriguez is a teenager that's gotten to high A. He's a Dominican that was one of the top July 2 signings a couple years back. He has a lot of the same tools, but he has better contact ability. He is, you know, a big, lanky, explosive right fielder with huge raw power. It's at least a 7 on the 2-8 scale. Huge exit velos. And he also, I think, is most notable for both that precocious contact ability and ability to manipulate the barrel head and pick out good pitches while also having a ton of power. It's sort of like a power pitcher that also throws strikes as a teenager. It's very rare. And he also is one of the rare Latin players where scouts just rave about his makeup because, you know, usually these guys don't speak the language or in a country they're not familiar with. They're just, you know, sort of getting their feet under them. And everyone is just convinced this guy's going to figure stuff out. There's like a level of certainty around him that you do not hear, especially around Latin players, which I think is probably, you know, a little bit of like scouts tend to be American that are scouting these guys in America. And these guys are from a different country. So the fact that like scouts are totally sold on this guy, I think sort of underlines it even more.
Now, a guy he's going to be teammates with perhaps for years, Jared Kelenic, used to be with the Mets, was traded in that big controversial deal involving Robinson Cano and Edwin Diaz. Where do you have him in your rankings?
I think I'm 13th. I'm just behind Rodriguez, which I also think is, I think a lot of teams would have that flipped, but I think everybody has them pretty close. Kelenic is a guy that goes all the way back to like freshman, sophomore year in high school, even when he, you know, was based in Wisconsin. He was going to all of the Team USA stuff, all the summer showcase stuff, and he would be consistently playing kids 2 and 3 years older than him and standing out at that point. And he has taken that sort of predicted linear path, where he just keeps getting better and keeps getting better. He was a center fielder with sort of sneaky power. He's now sort of filling out a little bit more. Looks like he's more likely to be a right fielder, but it's going to be plus power, plus hit. Moving quickly through the minors will probably be AA this year, maybe even AAA. And I think 2021, there's a chance that him and Julio Rodriguez will be in the outfield for the Mariners. And so obviously their rebuild is kind of hung on those two guys.
The comp I've heard on him is Grady Sizemore. What do you think of that? Disagree with it?
Yeah, no, I think that's about right. I think Grady might have been a little better runner defender, but it's, that's in the ballpark.
All right. A lot of conversation around Luis Robert. What do you see in him?
So he was a guy that I've gone back and forth on a lot. And I mentioned this in the meeting yesterday. When I was with Fangraphs, we would go through with teams, Eric and I, and sort of ask them to grade on the 2080 scale, a player's pitch selection, because we started noticing that projecting a hit tool was very difficult when you don't sort of split that out as a separate ability. Because some guys, you know, groove swing right through the zone. They can only hit one kind of pitch. Other guys just swing at everything. And those are two different ways to sort of affect how much contact you make. He has arguably the worst pitch selection of anyone on the top 100. But on the other side, he is arguably the highest upside and has already performed in AAA. So he's sort of a man of extremes here. And because of that pitch selection issue, it isn't likely that it like makes a huge difference. Like, he's never probably going to be an above average guy in terms of selecting the right pitches to swing at. And so then the question is, well, then does he become like a Starling Marte type where he just is good enough that he can make that work? Obviously, like, you know, Ichiro, Vlad Sr., some of these guys can make that sort of thing work if they're elite enough in terms of creating contact with bat control. There's also examples all the way down to Lewis Brinson, who has, you know, comparable tools and has had a lot of trouble in the big leagues because of pitch selection. So I think for a guy that appears to be super consensus, performs in AAA, has all these tools, there's like a pretty wide variance of what his first couple years could look like. But I think once he gets in third, fourth, fifth year, I think he'll be what everyone is expecting him to be.
Again, you can find Kylie's lists on ESPN.com as top 100. Among those guys, and, you know, fans always love to ask this question, which guy on that list do you think is going to have the biggest impact in the big leagues in 2020? I'm guessing Gavin Lux.
Yeah, that was the one that came to mind. He, as I mentioned yesterday, there's like a little bit of question around his defense, how consistently he can sort of field and throw the ball at second base. But in terms of hit power, readiness, role to play in the big leagues, team that is good at helping you work through, you know, issues you might have at the plate, like, he seems like the most slam dunk guy in that regard.
Now, during the winter, as you know, there was talk of the Dodgers with the Indians about Francisco Lindor, and there was some early speculation that Gavin Lux would be in that deal. And I had a couple of executives basically burst out loud over the phone like, yeah, in this day and age, no one's giving up Gavin Lux for a guy for 2 years control. Just explain for folks who might not know, why would that be?
So if you want to do the cold economical thing and boil these guys down to a dollar amount, which every team does at some level, even though we realize that there's, you know, variance in humanity and stuff involved, Gavin Lux will be making the big league minimum for 3 years. You'd probably guess he'd be worth 20, 30, maybe 40 or $50 million based on how he performs. And then he'll be, you know, performing even better than that. So, you know, you could, whatever you'd want to say, that his performance will be worth $150 million and you might pay him 20 or 30. So it's like, I think easily a $100 million asset if you like sort of were to like, you know, have an auction for that player or a draft where there was no cap. And Lindor like simply cannot create that much value unless he has back-to-back MVP seasons, which, you know, could happen. But not even like top 10 MVP, but like the MVP twice in a row, which obviously he hasn't done and very few players have ever done, to sort of capture that level of value. And that's the sort of math teams are doing when it comes to like making decisions on trades. It's not quite as this guy's better than that guy and we want to win. They're like starting with that math.
Especially because Lindor now is really expensive and he would suck up a lot of that value based on his salary. You described a really interesting prospect in our meeting yesterday, O'Neill Cruz.
Yeah, so I guess my sort of story with him began when I saw him at an international showcase, and it was a crazy showcase. It included Juan Soto, Fernando Tatis Jr., O'Neill Cruz. There's like a lot of big names there that, of course, they're 15 years old. Like, I wasn't 100% sure who these guys were going to be at this point. And even Juan Soto did not like stand out at that time. He was one of the better players, but not clearly the best. Cruz was 6'1", about 170 at this point when he was 15 years old. He is now 6'7", probably like 240, 250. He is still playing shortstop. And I asked the scout, I was like, what does that look like at shortstop? Like, I can't imagine that. And he goes, it looks like an octopus. Like, it's all arms and legs. He's all over the place. It's not necessarily the prettiest thing in the world, but he just like scoops up everything. And I'm like, do you think he stays there? He's like, well, technically he looks fine there, but like how many 6'7" infielders will there be? Like, I have to like create my scouting report based on comparisons. And like, no one's ever been taller than like 6'5" and played these positions. And he's like, you know, is he more talented than Troy Gloss defensively? Like, maybe, but there's just not many guys to look at. So he's like, I imagine he'll probably play right field, but he's like, he's also a plus runner. Like, you could probably stick him in center field and he'd be okay. And I'm like, so you're talking, and then the part I haven't even mentioned yet, he has either 70 or 80 raw power. So it's like, you know, left-handed, Aaron Judge playing shortstop, which, you know, is another guy where it's hard to find a guy that's come in the past that you can compare him to and try to wrap your arms around what he's going to be. And the other funny thing is O'Neill Cruz has that same issue that we're talking about with Luis Robert, where he's not as selective as you'd want him to be. And he has super long arms, which usually ties guys up and limits their contact ability. So it's like, I'm talking about Luis Robert having like a high variance in what his first couple years in the big leagues would be. Like O'Neill Cruz, you can't even find someone to compare him to. And he also has all of these outlier skills. Like, I have no idea where this is going to go, but he like keeps performing. So, you know, it's kind of hard to bet against this guy. I want to see this in the big leagues.
We got a minute left. I got one more for you. The Padres, I know from your team rankings, they've got a ton of high-end talent. We've seen the front end of that. Do you think it can manifest itself quickly enough to satisfy an increasingly impatient ownership?
It's tough because I think A.J. Preller's strength is building a farm system, picking young players, and he has not proven, it may still be, but he hasn't proven that he can build a playoff team. And I think he is hanging the rebuild on Tatis, Paddock, two guys near the top of my rankings, Mackenzie Gore and Luis Patino, both hitters. Also, Luis Campusano, a catcher, is up there as well. But I think he wants the playoff team, similar to the Royals, to be led by these homegrown players who he thinks are going to be his stars. They're going to be, you know, five-win players, seven- and eight-level guys. And if these guys aren't ready, I don't know if that's a playoff team. And so if they come through and, you know, these pitchers do something like the Mets group did when these three guys come up and they're all great right away, then I think it'll happen. And if they don't, I mean, young pitchers, as we know, are a little wonky sometimes. And like Fernando Tatis throwing the ball in the dugout a lot, it's tough. And I think he's changed up what he's doing a bit. And, you know, the trades this year, I think, are indicating a different direction, trying to figure out how to make this team into a short-term winner. But I'm sort of worried if these young players don't come through, I don't know if it's going to be there in the short term and he'll be around to see all of it.
Especially with the Dodgers in their division, yes?
Yeah, and the Diamondbacks are one of the most well-run teams in baseball, like regardless of where they are in terms of, you know, competing, rebuilding, you know, whatever they're trying to do, like they're going to be in the mix every year.
All right, Kylie. Hey, thanks for doing this. Congratulations on the book. I look forward to reading it.
Yep, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Bye, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
Hembo is Paul Imbakite. He's a researcher at ESPN who's a honcho on the show Get Up. He tells us he's the head honcho. We have not been able to confirm that. Hembo, good to talk with you.
Buster, good to talk baseball with you.
I noticed on Get Up, yeah, they've been talking about a quarterback. I can't remember his name, up in New England someplace.
You know, this would have all been so much easier, Buster, if he just became a catcher for the Expos like he should have so many years ago.
Doesn't it feel like a little bit of a comp to when Derek Jeter was a free agent, and then it was a big, it got kind of ugly, like the Yankees negotiations with Derek, and eventually he went back. That's what I think is going to happen in the end. What do you think?
I think he's going to go play for someone else, but I know for certain that over the next 2 weeks I will be nauseated on a daily basis hearing about his, you know, Kardashian like free agency tour, but such is life.
All right, let's talk some baseball. This week was a big week for contract extensions. Yoan Moncada, the most recent one, agreed to with the White Sox. What do you make of that deal?
The White Sox are really building something here, Buster, and this is clearly a plan that they've chosen to employ over the last few seasons under Rick Hahn. The 5-year, $70 million extension for Moncada obviously feels kind of team-friendly. He also extended Aaron Bummer earlier in the offseason. Luis Robert signed a 6-year, $50 million extension without any experience, and a year ago, it did the same with Eloy Jimenez, and the year before that, it was Tim Anderson. So in total, those players, they signed for a total of $204 million over 28 years, 28 prime years, Buster. And that, I think, is a really, really smart formula for any team, but especially a team like the White Sox that don't really have the desire to go crazy with their payroll. And it's just funny to me because you might remember a year ago, they went all in, at least so we thought, on Manny Machado, and they offered him this huge 9-figure contract. You're going to get 28 prime years out of these guys for $204 million. You also have Andrew Vaughn and Nick Madrigal and Michael Kopech coming up through the system. This is the foundation. This is the way that you build a great team. I think they'll probably look back on last offseason as a good missed opportunity, and instead investing their money into their own homegrown players, sort of like the Astros did. I think they're really building something special.
So I'm going to pull a scab for you, a Phillies fan. Compare the rebuild of your Phillies with the years in which they tanked with that of the White Sox.
Well, the problem with the Phillies is that they went so far off the deep end financially before that. So Ruben Amaro just gave out contracts, ridiculous contracts to older players, and they were so unwilling to admit that the window was closed. the good thing for the White Sox is they never really had that open window as far as Rakan was concerned. So it's taking them a long time to get there. But the organization is now filled with premium talent. They have a top 10 farm system and all these young guys now coming up under these affordable contracts. To me, this is the formula for teams. And I think they're just a year or two away from really exploding.
What do you make of Christian Yelich's extension?
Well, this is a team-friendly extension, as team-friendly as $215 million can be, because this guy's probably worth twice that. I mean, Mike Trout signed a contract for twice that. But what's curious to me, Buster, and I sent these numbers to you earlier in the week, is that I still think we don't consider him the superstar that we should. Going back to the 2018 All-Star break, which, as you know, is really the time in which he truly embraced sort of the launch angle phenomenon and really begun spinning the baseball in a way that, you know, great power hitters do, in a way that he can take advantage of that hitter-friendly ballpark in Milwaukee. He owns advantages over Mike Trout in batting average, in slugging, in OPS, in weighted runs created plus, in average exit velocity, in WAR, and in win probability added. We're talking about a year and a half of play here. Now, no sane person would say Christian Yelich is better than Mike Trout because of that. But when I look at those numbers objectively and I watch the kid play, he's clearly right now the best player in the National League.
Yeah, and arguably the best pure hitter in baseball. Just purely as a hitter, he might hold that title right now. And this week, of course, we've heard so much about the potential loss of Giancarlo Stanton and Aaron Judge during the year. But part of the reason why the Yankees are preeminent, just as the Dodgers are, is because they've gotten a lot of cheap production. Give us some details on that.
They sure have, Buster. When you asked me to dig into this early in the week, frankly, I sort of rolled my eyes, because last season the Yankees spent $93 million in players just on the injured list. That was more than the entire payroll of six teams. So what that made me think was, well, look, obviously they're just benefiting from this monster payroll. But in fact, when I dug into the numbers, I think your stance on this is right. Last season, Buster, eight of their top nine position players by wins above replacement made less than $1 million. And obviously some notable examples of those players are Mike Tauschman and Gio Urshela, Luke Voigt and Cameron Maben. All those guys contributed in big ways. In total, 42% of Yankees WAR came from traded four players, Buster, last year. For a team like the Yankees, who at least historically have been so invested in free agency, that number was the fifth highest mark in baseball, and by far the highest mark of any team that we consider a big market team. So the Yankees sort of have a moneyball formula of their own. I think obviously fans like to crush the Yankees because they spend a lot of money. But Brian Cashman deserves enormous credit for the players that he has identified specifically with his trades and position players that have really exploded for this club. And it looks like, at least to start this season, that's going to be a really important thing for them too, again, with Aaron Judge and Stanton likely out to start the year.
All right, Hembo, send me that data. I'll put it in the Sunday column.
Oh, you got it, bud. Talk to you soon.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. Mitchell writes in at Tigers of Detroit. If you had to bet correctly on predicting an MLB division 1-5, which division would you predict? Which would you not touch with a 10-foot pole?
Yeah, and Taylor, you and I sort of previewed this earlier in the week when we talked about the American League East, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Where we know who the last place team is. We have an idea of who's going to be third and fourth with the Red Sox and the Blue Jays. We know that the Rays and Yankees are separated from the top of the division. So I'd go American League East, where I feel like it's going to be Yankees, Rays, then I'd say Red Sox, and then I'll say Jays, and then I'll say Orioles. You agree with me on that one among the six divisions?
Absolutely. I'm not going to call it a slam dunk. Of course, anything can happen, but just based on what we heard, especially on Tuesday, that sounds like how it's going to unfold.
Yeah, and I would think about for the division that I wouldn't touch, National League East is in that conversation to some degree. But you know what? The National League Central would be mine, because I think legitimately, you know, four of the five teams could win that division. And I don't know if that's the case in the National League East.
I guess the Nationals and the Braves kind of jockeying back and forth in my mind for the East. And maybe the Mets. I mean, I feel like a lot of people are high on the Mets as well. So I'd go with the East there, too.
Well, I'd go with the Central, because I think the East is in the conversation. I actually think the Mets could win the East. And in the Central, if you told me the Reds won the division, that wouldn't be a shocker. Cardinals are good. Cubs should be good. And the Brewers should be good. And the Brewers have been making the playoffs in recent years.
Eric E. at Esoteric Zero. That's a tough one.
Esoteric Eric.
Esoteric Eric. Oh, boy. Can't read today. Good, good. If you had to rank these young Dynamo starters based on their potential, what order would you put them in? Zach Gallen, Chris Paddock, Mike Soroka, That's it. That's the list.
I'd go Soroka, Paddock, and Gallen in that order. I love Chris Paddock. I want to see more out of Zach Gallen this year. If Zach Gallen steps up and is a big time contributor this year, then he could vault the Diamondbacks into the playoff conversation.
Last one for the week. Matthew Kleeter at Matthew Havach. Will McGrath. Good Lord. This is a rough Friday outing. Will Miguel Cabrera get to 500 dingers this year?
The question is, yeah, but see, we got to have a competition this year between your bleacher tweet reads and some of my ad reads. And which one feels at 10 times more stilted, right? Because I'm looking at yours and I'm like, Matthew Kleator, I'm thinking is what he might mean, or Matthew K. Vatch could be his, right?
See, the difference between the bleacher tweets and the ad reads is I clean the ad reads up for you. I leave this in for the listeners' enjoyment. So if you guys want to throw names at me just for fun, I won't practice them at home and I'll read them on the air.
There we go. Will Miguel Cabrera get to 500 dingers this year? I think he will. He looks great. We talked about it earlier in the week. I had a conversation with him. He didn't tell me how much weight he lost, but he looks like he's dropped about 30 pounds and he just needs 23 homers. So yeah, I'd say he's going to.
Alrighty, that is Bleacher Tweets for the week. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. You guys have been great at it. Keep them coming. If you haven't already listened, our AL East preview was on Tuesday. We did the NL West yesterday. Next Tuesday, we're going to do the AL Central. And next Thursday, we are doing the NL East. So lots of previews to come.
I'm glad you're keeping that straight for me, Taylor. I wouldn't have been able to keep that going. And my thanks today to you and to Troy, to Kylie and to Hembo. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening this week. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.